Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
English Press. I think this is the second occasion on which a Massey lecturer has spoken at the Institute. John Rawson Saul spoke here some years ago, and tonight it's Margaret Somerville. I'll introduce her briefly. She's well known to many of you, I guess, for her international reputation, but also for appearances on the international media, including the media in Australia. Margaret Somerville is the founding director of the Centre for Medicine, Ethics and Law at McGill University, where she holds the Samuel Gow Chair in the Faculty of Law and is a professor in the Faculty of Medicine. She's also a consultant to governments and non-government bodies worldwide, and of course is the recipient of many awards. She lives in Montreal, Canada, but returns to Australia reasonably regularly. And tonight, when it was put to Anne herself about what will be a great topic for Professor Somerville to address, we came up with the idea after she thought it through and changed the topic a little bit. But the final topic we agreed on was an alternative to Richard Dawkins' God's delusional views. Margaret Somerville, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Jared, and thank you everyone for coming, and Your Eminence, Your Lordship, Honourable Judges, ladies and gentlemen. I had so much I wanted to say to you tonight, and that's always a disaster when you have to give a speech. So I'm going to try to do my best to get through most of what I'd like to say. And just to put you in the picture, I sort of chose seven topics. The first one is finding a shared ethics. The second one is ways of knowing. The third one is called basic presumptions. The fourth is language. The fifth is the challenge of science to the human spirit. The sixth is why are atheists so passionate about their disbelief. And the seventh is three competing worldviews as a basis for a new societal paradigm. So let's see what we can do out of that list. Finding a shared ethics. Richard Dawkins cast the current great societal ethical values debate as consisting of a series of either-or choices, either them or us, either atheism or religion, either reason or emotion and mysticism, either science or religion. I believe we must accommodate all of these realities, and doing that is my goal in proposing that we need to search for a shared ethics. Indeed, that was the theme of my Massey Lectures, which is the book that's over there. That book essentially is about searching for a shared ethics. I might also add that when I did the first draft of it, it was 165,000 words. CBC had a complete and utter freak out, and the eventual book is 65,000 words. In particular, Dawson dismisses religion, emotion, and mysticism at least as valid ways of human knowing at anything more than the personal, individual level, and he advocates atheism, reason, and science. I strongly disagree with him in that and many other respects. A few years ago, Richard Dawkins and I had an exchange of views at a meeting at Oxford, at which James Watson, the co-discoverer of DNA and Nobel Prize winner, who agrees with Dawkins strongly about religion, was also present. At the coffee break, just after this exchange, Jim Watson came up to me and said, "You know, Margot, the problem with you is that you're full of mystical nonsense." Mystical nonsense is a real danger that one must guard against. But I think that Richard Dawkins and James Watson, as it happens, are mystically tone deaf, which is a much more serious danger. Reason and science give us access to astonishing, indeed world and mind-altering knowledge about our physical universe, including ourselves. Spiritual experience, which I use in a religiously neutral sense, but which can be encountered by some people through religion, gives us access to knowledge of a different kind and of a different reality, which cannot be accessed through science. Dawkins critiques religion from many perspectives, one being the mysteries that religion represents, but he does this through the lens of science. That tells him there is nothing present in religion. His mistake is that it's the wrong lens with which to explore metaphysical realities. Just as the religious lens on science would not allow nature to unveil its mysteries to the scientist, a scientific lens on religion gives us the same outcome. And just as not being able to access scientific truths through a religious lens does not mean there is no reality to those scientific truths, the same is true for religious truths. When we put a scientific lens on them, it won't show us what they are. I want to explain here that by mysteries, I mean that which we do not understand, or at least fully understand, and in some cases might never be able to understand. In short, mysteries must be distinguished from fantasies, which are not real. Second, I want to emphasize that by mysteries, I do not necessarily mean anything supernatural, although the approach that I'm suggesting to a shared ethics can accommodate people who are religious and indeed those who are not religious. I propose that as both individuals and societies, we're frightened of mysteries. They elicit deep, free-floating anxiety and fear. It's a normal human response to fear to try to take control of the situation that elicits it. We do that in contemporary societies by converting a mystery to a problem and then seeking a technological solution to that problem. Take, for instance, our fear of death. We convert the mystery of death to the problem of death and propose a lethal injection, euthanasia, as the technological solution to that problem. That gives us the illusion of control over death, which reduces our anxiety and fear. We can't avoid death, but we can set the terms of its timing, place, and manner. So I think that in order to respond ethically to some of these issues, we have to regain a sense of deeper comfort, I think would be the words I'd use, with mysteries. Faith and reason are not, as Dawkins proposes, incompatible, and neither is science and religion incompatible. In this respect, Dawkins, who is a fundamentalist atheist, and apparently he's furious with me for calling him a fundamentalist, I believe actually that atheism is a secular religion. And fundamentalist atheists and religious fundamentalists are similar. They take an either-or approach to everything. My belief or yours, religion or science, reason or faith, and so on. Then they seek to reconcile what they see as the conflicts between the two elements that make up each of these pairings by dropping one or other of them. Dawkins' call for the elimination of religion demonstrates such a choice on his part. One problem in this approach is that proposing that these elements are in conflict is not neutral in terms of impact on finding a shared ethics. It's very harmful to attaining that goal. Dawkins would like to reduce religion to nothing more than a personal fantasy or superstition, but that's not a realistic goal. It's an impossible dream on his part. The vast majority of people are unlikely to be convinced to abandon religion. So at best, Dawkins' prescription for reducing current world conflicts will fail. At worst, it will do serious harm. It will exacerbate the acrimony of the values conflicts and make it more likely, not less likely, that religion will become the focus of such conflicts. Also, because culture and religion are linked, even within democratic, multicultural, pluralistic Western societies, it will increase the number and intensity of the current values clashes and may contribute to culture wars. Dawkins is correct that religion can be wrongly used, but so can science. Take the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Using religion to convince the 9/11 terrorists to commit mass murder by knocking down the World Trade Towers was a profoundly evil use of religion. Using aeroplanes to carry out that evil was a profoundly evil use of aeronautical science. However, Dawkins looks only at the evil uses of religion, never the good it affects, and only the good uses of science, never the harm it does. A balanced ethical approach requires us to recognise both the goods and harms of both religion and science, and to try to stop the evil uses and to promote the good uses of each. In short, we need to make a distinction, one that Dawkins fails to make, between what religion is and how religion is used. And the same is true for science. As a person dealing with bioterrorism in various contexts in both North America and actually sort of more globally through World Health Organization, that's exactly true what we're doing with science. That's the motto that we're using is how can we prevent the life sciences from becoming the death sciences in the hands of bioterrorists. So we're not saying don't do any life sciences, we're saying how can we stop their evil use. So how should we deal with the divisions among us and the conflict that results? I believe one of the greatest current challenges, in fact, in my view, the greatest in terms of leaving a reasonably safe, secure, and undamaged world for future generations, that is, leaving a world in which our descendants, as reasonable people, would want to live, is to find a shared ethics that crosses the perceived faith, reason, and science-religion divides. That means we need to search for a shared ethics for an interdependent world. That is, as Prime Minister Tony Blair suggested, a world in which a crisis somewhere is necessarily a crisis elsewhere and sometimes a crisis everywhere. In other words, we must try to find those values we hold in common and to imagine how we might go about doing so. I believe that requires us to recognise the importance of stories, myths, poetry, imagination, examined emotions, intuition, especially moral intuition, and the human spirit to human ethics. It's not that reason, common sense, objective facts, and science are unimportant to ethics. On the contrary, rather the problem is, as is true of Dawkins, they're often assumed to be the only matters important to ethics, as I discuss shortly. I adamantly disagree with that exclusionary stance. It's essential that we use the full richness of our human ways of knowing to find a shared ethics in our contemporary society. Just very briefly, what do I mean by a shared ethics? I do not mean a universal ethics. What I mean by it is that we will try to find where we can agree with other people in any given context. And that by doing that, we can experience ourselves in that particular context as belonging to the same moral community. The benefits of engaging in a collective search to find some shared ethics include that it's a realistic goal, it's likely to produce greater agreement on ethics. Also, and probably most importantly, it constructs the who, the we are, as a fluid, flexible concept that can change in different situations. So by a shared ethics, I do not mean that we'll have one monolithic universal ethics, nor do I mean that we'll all just accept each other's ethics, what is called an ethical pluralism, nor do I accept moral relativism, that everyone's view on ethics is as good as anyone else's, nor do I accept ethical cosmopolitanism, if that means that we must be equally concerned for and equally bonded to everyone. Humans have evolved over thousands of years to bond to special others, such as family and friends, or some larger group, some special other living beings, such as pets, and special land, often a country of birth or homeland. We bond more strongly, or in a different way, inside these parameters than outside them, and ethics must accommodate those realities. And sometimes that's extremely difficult to do. And a major function of the shared ethics is to accommodate as many of us as possible, in particular to cross the spiritual, religious, atheist divide and the religion-science one. That is, to hold as many of us as possible, whatever our beliefs, in a structure that allows the tensions between us to become creative, to engender what I call creative tension, and prevent those tensions from converting to destructive ones. Ways of knowing, and I can see I'm going to have to go a lot faster than this. Anyway, but the human ways of knowing, this is where I think Richard Dawkins and I part company most dramatically. This is what he meant by me being, or what James Watson meant by me being full of mystical nonsense. I believe that our human ways of knowing are multiple and diverse and encompass the mind, body, heart and spirit. Gerard spoke to you that John Ralston's Saul addressed the Sydney Institute. Well, in the book that he wrote for the Massey Lectures, The Unconscious Civilization, he introduced us to some of our multiple ways of knowing. Common sense, human memory, which is what he calls history, imagination and creativity, intuition, I'd emphasize moral intuition, reason and ethics. I would expressly add experiential knowledge and underline its importance to ethics, because experiential knowledge cuts across all of the other ways of knowing used in doing ethics. As well, we can employ examined emotions, intellectual, emotional and spiritual curiosity, its necessary companion doubt, and physical knowledge, what we can learn from, as the gym trainers say, listening to our bodies. But a warning, it would be as much a mistake to focus only on experiential knowledge or creativity and imagination, including knowledge, for instance, generated by play, which I happen to think is important, as it would be to focus only on hard science methodologies such as statistics. What I believe is needed in searching for a shared ethics to govern the new techno-science is not a disjunctive approach to our ways of knowing, but a conjunctive one. We need good scientific methodologies, good facts on the one hand, and space for imagination, creativity and experiential knowledge, good ethics on the other. And we need to integrate both into a seamless whole. It's essential then to recognise that all of these ways of knowing must be held in dynamic balance. As important as anyone might be in understanding the ethics of a given situation, any one way of knowing, unbalanced by the others, is likely to lead us astray. So when I speak of the importance of the imagination, for example, in understanding a particular situation, I'm not putting down reason or thereby science. I think they're immensely important. A focus on reason is at the heart of Richard Dawkins' views. The nature, worth, and valid role of reason are collectively often at the centre of strong disagreement about ethics, and that's true with respect to Dawkins' views and mine. I can't explore the definitions and nature of reason here, but I accept theologian Paul Tillich's distinction between technical reason, how to do something, and ontological reason, seeking answers to questions such as, what am I doing here? What is the purpose and meaning of life? As Tillich emphasises, we need to distinguish the situations in which the use of one or other of those forms of reasons is valid. Although Tillich did not argue against those who use technical reason in the service of limited goals, curing a disease, say, or building a bridge, he did argue against those who use it automatically in the service of all goals. That, I propose, is what Richard Dawkins does. Ontological reason, not technical reason, is what people need when exploring what Tillich called ultimate concerns, the universal and existential problems through which humans explore meaning, purpose, and identity. Such ultimate concerns are at the heart of ethics and need to be explored through all our ways of knowing. I actually propose that reason is a secondary, but it's essential, verification mechanism. It allows us to check that we've not gone off course with our other ways of knowing. It's also worth noting that people other than scientists can believe that reason is the only valid way of knowing or deciding. Take, for example, and here to the judges, the idea that judges in court use only legal reasoning in interpreting and applying the law. Are they really doing that? We only have to look at our famous Lord Denning's judgments that every law school in any Anglo-Saxon part of the world studies. And his opening words in one of his famous decisions are, "Poor Mrs. Brown. 50 pages of tight legal reasoning later," he says, Mrs. Brown wins. He uses reason to check his gap reaction. To summarise, the problem is not the use of reason. The problem, as far as doing ethics is concerned, is the glorification of reason to the exclusion of other ways of knowing. Indeed, a very recent, 3 weeks ago, article in Nature, which is one of the two top science journals in the world, I'm happy to say, called The Moral Brain, gives us scientific evidence to that effect. People with damage to the parts of their brains that process emotions, but who have intact centres for rational judgment, made ethically inappropriate decisions. To quote, this is from the study, "The study provides evidence that good moral decision-making is based on emotion, as well as rational thought, and I think it's based on a lot of other things as well. Reason and faith are often posited as the two mutually exclusive ways of knowing. Faith is a non-rational but not irrational way of knowing. But might reason and faith be opposite poles on a spectrum along which the other ways of knowing fall? In that case, some of those other ways of knowing might manifest several characteristics, some of which traditionally would be seen as falling only within reason, and others only within faith. This idea of a continuum rather than a binary approach might allow us to find common territory no matter from which pole we start, that is the faith or the reason one. And once again, that might help us define some consensus on ethics. Basic presumptions, the next topic. The basic presumptions that we use and the analytic structures to decide about ethics are not neutral. They influence and often determine the outcome of a debate in which there are conflicting views. Basic presumptions are the foundation stones from which we start an ethical analysis. We can't avoid such a starting point, but we usually take whatever basic presumption we use to ground our ethical analysis as self-evident, as a given, and most often those basic presumptions are not specifically identified. But in fact, there is a choice to be made, and that choice has far from a neutral effect on our ethical analysis and consequently on our decisions. Basic presumptions allocate the burden of proof. When there is equal doubt about an issue, the basic presumption prevails. Richard Dawkins' presumption is that there is no God, and therefore those who believe that there is must prove it. But the equally valid basic presumption is that there is a God, and those who don't believe that must prove that. Because both are tenable basic presumptions, both must be accommodated in a secular society. In contrast to such an approach, and ironically, where Dawkins and religious fundamentalists are ad idem, is that each wants to impose their choice between their basic presumptions on everyone else. Where they differ is only with respect to their choice of basic presumptions, which of course are of opposite content. I only want to mention here the basic procedural presumption that I've been working with lately to ground ethical analysis. That is a basic presumption in favour of nature, the natural, and life. Such a presumption is reflected in the foundational doctrines that inform many of the world's great religions. Essentially, a basic presumption in favour of nature, the natural, and life means that people, in particular scientists, who want to interfere with nature, the natural, or life, have the burden of proving that what they want to do is ethical. The alternative presumption is one in favour of technoscience. That is, we may change our world and ourselves with that technoscience until we find that our actions involve serious risks and harm. I leave it to you to guess which of the presumptions Richard Dawkins chooses. Language. Words matter. Language is never neutral in ethics, and in many ways, choosing our language is one of the greatest challenges in searching for a shared ethics for a global world. It can attract or repel, reveal or conceal, calm or anger, give or take power, create or destroy trust. I've long thought that we'll find a shared ethics through the language of poetry. I believe that the language of poetry is the way in which we can best have access to as many as possible of our ways of knowing. In the past, the arts, including poetry, were closely entwined with religion. The great religious texts relied on poetry because, like all true art, poetry gives us access to metaphysical and spiritual realities. One problem in our secular societies today is the traditional connection between religion and poetry, and therefore between the language of both, can mean that those who reject religion also object to a language of ethics they characterize because of its poeticism as quasi-religious. That's a serious mistake. We need such language to access the full spectrum of our human ways of knowing, especially moral intuition, imagination, and creativity. And we need a language of moral intuition and creativity, because it's primarily through that that we can deepen the understanding we require to make decisions on ethical matters. We also need to find a respectful common language if we define some ethics and values we share. That means that religious people must try to explain their values in secular language, and secular people must stop dismissing and denigrating religious people or their values just because the people holding those views are religious. We should consider Dawkins' choice of language regarding religion and religious people from this perspective. To say the least, it's intensely denigrating, condescending, and ridiculing. The same is true, perhaps even more forcefully, with respect to Christopher Hitchens, who refers to religious people as mammals. Finally, in relation to language, Dawkins and people with fundamentalist religious beliefs are again, ironically, ad idem with respect to another mistake involving language. They both interpret mythos as logos. Picasso said about art that art is the lie that tells the truth. The same is true for myth. Myth is not a lie or fantasy. It's a way of speaking about realities that can't be described in any other way. A major example that Dawkins uses in his book to decry religion is the story of Abraham and Isaac, in which Abraham is going to sacrifice his firstborn son to God. Dawkins interprets this story literally as yet another example of the evils of God, of a belief in him, and of religion. He asks rhetorically what kind of horrific God would want fathers to kill their sons in order to please him. At the time that that was written, around 4,000 years ago, it was common practice in the tribes of the Middle East, including by the Jews, to sacrifice the firstborn son. The story was a message to the Jews not to do so. That sacrifice was to be replaced by a ritualized sacrifice, the circumcision of infant males, the procedure that God commanded Abraham to implement. In other words, no matter what we think about infant male circumcision, and I should add that I happen to disagree with it and have been at the centre of a huge public controversy about that in Canada, it's infinitely preferable and more humane than infant male sacrifice. As Terry, well, it's just simply that Dawkins just doesn't understand. I mean, it's so amazing that he does the same thing as he accuses the fundamentalists of doing. I mean, they read literally creation. He reads literally Abraham and Isaac. As Terry Eagleton, eminent professor of literature in the UK, said in reviewing The God Delusion in the London Review of Books, Richard Dawkins' writing on religion is like someone writing on science, whose sole familiarity with science is the Book of British Birds. So, fifth topic is the challenge of science to the human spirit. Today's mind-altering, world-altering scientific breakthroughs are challenging our ancient human philosophical heritage in unprecedented ways. I use that term, human philosophical spiritual heritage, in the largest possible sense, is encompassing all of our most important shared values, attitudes, principles and beliefs, whatever their source. And here again, Dawkins and I part company, this time with respect to spirituality. I regard spirituality as a natural inherent characteristic common to all humans, which some people express through religious belief and practice, and others express in secular ways. We can call our capacity to experience that spirituality, the human spirit, a term I use in a religiously neutral sense. It's the intangible, immeasurable, numinous reality that all of us need in order to find meaning in life and to make life worth living. It's that deeply intuitive sense of relatedness or connectedness to all life, especially other people, to the world and to the universe in which we live. The metaphysical, but not necessarily supernatural, reality which we need to experience to live fully human lives. Some people see the new technoscience, for instance genetics, as challenging a belief that there's anything more to being human than the physical. In other words, as challenging the existence of the human spirit. Whether there is such a challenge depends on how we view that science. Science, I think, and for me it does, opens up amazement, awe and wonder about what we don't know, rather than showing us, as Dawkins believes, that we're nothing more than a physical reality, that our primary purpose is to be the carriers of the selfish genes into the next generation and to ensure their immortality. The universality of the search for morality and ethics by most people and in all kinds of societies, as far as we have recorded human history, suggests that there is a common origin for this uniquely human trait of searching for morality. The German philosopher Jürgen Habermas speaks of an ethics of the species as being innate to being human. I call this human ethics, because I don't want to get mixed up with my friend and opponent, Peter Singer's speciesism. So that's why I like human ethics better. The universality of our search for morality and this suggests this genetic base. I believe we're likely to discover that spirituality, and here the cardinal may be absolutely horrified, but that's okay. I believe that we're likely to discover that spirituality also has a genetic base, and that religion is one way we express spirituality. But let me be clear here what I mean by genetic base. In saying this, I'm not, as I would assume Dawkins is, a genetic reductionist. I do not accept the idea that we're no more than the functioning of our genes. In other words, I reject the gene machine, genes are us view, and evolutionary sociobiology's approach that we're nothing more than gene machines. You probably all know Jeff Kennett, who used to be Premier of Victoria. I was once arguing with him at a conference on euthanasia. And in arguing for the legalisation of euthanasia, Jeff Kennett expressed that reductionist view in this way. Only an Australian could say this, I think. He said, when you passed your best before or use by date, you should be checked out as quickly, cheaply and efficiently as possible. I believe that we're more than human products to be checked out of a supermarket of life. We are human beings, and while the essence of that being includes our genes, we are more than our genes. Rather, I see genes that give us the capacities for certain behaviours or experiences, which might perhaps include spirituality, as being like a television set or a radio. They're necessary instruments if we want to see or hear a program, but they don't determine the content of that program. To summarise, I'm not supporting genetic determinism or genetic reductionism. That is, we and all our experience are nothing more than gene functioning. Rather, I believe our genetic makeup might be a necessary substratum that opens up possibilities of having a wide variety of experiences of the human spirit that might not otherwise be available to us. If I'm correct that we have that capacity and it has a genetic base, then that might need to be initially turned on by particular kinds of experience. In short, it's possible that the capacity to experience spirituality might be what we're now calling an epigenetic phenomenon. Epigenetics is a new field of study of the interaction of genes and environment. We need both a gene and an environmental trigger to activate that gene, the technical word is imprinted, to have the capacity it gives us. Professor Michael Meaney, one of my colleagues at McGill, is doing work on nurturing behaviour in rats, and that powerfully demonstrates this epigenetic phenomenon. They found the gene for nurturing behaviour. But they've also found that unless the mother rat licks the baby rat within a very short critical window period after birth, that gene is never turned on, and that little baby rat might as well not have the gene. It can't lick, it can't nurture its own rats when she has her own baby rats later on. So, one of the things that comes out of that, just as an aside, is this idea that you can make kids grow up to be 20 and then they can decide whether or not they want religion and whether they, you know, what they will choose at that point. If it is, in fact, the capacity, the spirituality is epigenetic, it's highly likely, I think, that it has to be activated at a younger age. So one response to resolving the challenges unprecedented scientific breakthroughs present to our human spirit is to abandon the science. Religious fundamentalists take that route. The other is to abandon the philosophical spiritual heritage. Pure rationalists, like Richard Dawkins, do that. In other words, the people at each pole adopt the same strategy to reconcile what they perceive as a conflict between science and our philosophical spiritual heritage, although the content of what they abandon is the opposite. I believe that's a tragic mistake. Rather, we need a new vision that can facilitate the marriage of science and our human philosophical spiritual heritage and support the continuance of that marriage. And I think that one way to find that vision is by searching for a shared ethics. The sixth question was, why are atheists so passionate about their disbelief? I've long pondered that, and in fact, I responded to an article by Wendy Kamenei, who's at Radcliffe College. She published an article called The Last Taboo, Why America Needs Atheism. And I responded with an article called Why Are Atheists So Passionate About Disbelief? And actually, Wendy Kamenei is very laudatory about Dawkins and argues along very much the same lines. But why aren't atheists just indifferent to religion and people who are religious? Hate is not the opposite of love. Both are similar passions but of opposite content. Indifference is the opposite of both. I've already proposed that human search for spirituality might have a genetic base. If so, it would not be surprising that humans experience an inner space that needs to be filled, and if not filled by religion in its traditional mode, then it will need to be filled by something else that can function in a similar manner. I suggest that atheism is a secular religion, and atheists' passion about it could show that we have a need for some form of powerful belief or powerful disbelief in order to find meaning in life. Science can also function as a secular religion and does so when it becomes scientism. The same is indisputably true of humanism and of ethics when the latter becomes moralism. It's also true, and this is reinforced for me very dramatically in Australia, I believe of sport when it becomes sportism, especially when that's combined with another very powerful ism, nationalism. In short, we're witnessing the emergence of a very large number and range of secular religions. None of these isms is harmful in itself, but they are harmful to finding a shared ethics when they're promoted, as Dawkins does with scientism, to replace any space for spirituality and traditional religion in the public square and replace it with secularism, the encompassing secular religion that functions as a basket holding all the other secular religions. Let me be clear here. We are secular societies, and there is rightly a separation of church and state. The question is, what does respecting that separation require? People who are adamantly atheistic believe it means that religion must have no voice in the public square. I strongly disagree. I believe that religion is one voice among the many, including secular and atheistic voices, that has a right to participate and be heard in societal debates, especially those implicating our most important values and ethics. So finally, here's my conclusion. I believe that there are three worldviews competing as the basis for a new societal cultural paradigm. That is the story that we tell each other to show that we all belong together. It's a collection of beliefs, attitudes, principles, myths, whatever, that we all buy into and communicate in order to create the glue that binds us together as a society. And of course, the big question is, can we ever have a global society as compared to the global reality, and even more far distant, a global community? So those three views I've called the pure science view, the pure mystery view, and the science spirit view. The pure science view says we're highly complex biological machines, gene machines. Our rational, logical, cognitive capacities are our most valued features. It's intensely individualistic, liberal, postmodern, personal rights-based. It's uncomfortable with uncertainty. It seeks certainty through science and believes that everything can be explained eventually by science. It seeks a sense of control, and it has absolutely no room for mystery. The second view, the pure mystery view, is often associated with fundamentalist religious beliefs, whether, for example, Christian or Islamic. It's conservative, traditional, and emphasizes protection of the community. It engages a literal or logos reading of symbolic discourse, that is, mythos. It too is uncomfortable with uncertainty. It too seeks certainty, but instead of through science, it does it through religion. It too seeks a sense of control. Often, unlike science having no room for mystery, it has no room for science. So what we have to do is note the similarities in approach and process of pure science gene machine and pure mystery views, but their opposite substantive content. So the view that I propose is what I've called, for want of a better term, the science spirit view. It contrasts with both the other two views, and interestingly, in each case, it contrasts in the same way. It's excited by the new science. It increases our sense of wonder, awe, and true amazement. It believes that there's more to humans than their genes. There's a human spirit dimension, and for those who are religious, it can include a supernatural dimension. It's comfortable with uncertainty and recognizes that ethics, for instance, requires drawing lines in grey areas, sometimes very difficult ones. It accepts that there's much that we cannot control, that sometimes we simply have to live comfortably in the mystery. And it accepts that there's room for both science and mystery. This results, I think, in experiencing science as deepening our sense of wonder and awe. I've suggested that we need a notion of the secular sacred, which both the religious people and the atheists have powerfully rejected, which often tells you that there might be something in it if everybody hates it. The religious people rejected it because they said it was denigrating the sacred. That could only be religious. And the secular people rejected it because they said I was trying to impose religion on them because I was using the term sacred. However, we're working currently on bioterrorism. And one of the things that we're doing is trying to see if we can get everybody, we'll never get everybody to obey the rule, but get everybody who we can to agree that there are certain kinds of weapons, biological weapons, that should never be developed and let alone used. And what we need for that is a taboo. And the taboo is the other side of the coin of the sacred. So I believe we actually do need a secular sacred. The science spirit view has space for spirit and recognises that spirit needs protection. It recognises a mystery in human life and death, even if it's only a human mystery, and it recognises the mystery of the unknown, which can either be spelt with a small u or a capital U. The burning question is, can we find the moral will, political consensus and courage to adopt a stance that recognises that to preserve some of the moral, ethical and values realities that are essential to living a fully human life, in some circumstances we must have the courage to say no, even at personal cost to ourselves and others in failure to relieve suffering, at the cost of less rapid progress in science, at economic cost, and this is important for politicians, at political cost. The courage to say no translates to the courage to exercise wise ethical restraint. The most important fundamental question is, I believe, can the future trust us? Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.